Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On the subject of Osama bin Laden, he's responsible for the deaths of thousands of innocent Americans. He is now orchestrating other attacks on the United States of America. We will do whatever is necessary. We will track him down. We will capture, we will bring him to justice, and I'll follow him to the gates of hell.
It's 30 issues in 30 days, our presidential election series, issue 29 already. Can you believe it? And issue 29 is Pakistan and Afghanistan. John McCain has repeatedly promised to follow Osama bin Laden to the gates of hell, as he did in that clip. Barack Obama said yesterday that he would get out of Iraq to use the money we're spending there, quote, to turn back our attention to the fight we have not finished to snuff out bin Laden and the al-Qaeda terrorists, unquote. And he's also said this.
We have to press the Afghan government to make certain that they are actually working for their people. And I've said this to President Karzai.
Press the Afghan government to make sure they're working for their people, not just for U.S. national security. Iraq war critics often say Afghanistan and Pakistan are the central fronts in the war on terrorism, not Iraq. But we will begin with a contrarian view, which comes from one of New York's all-time contrarians, former Mayor Ed Koch. Mayor Koch, thanks for coming on WNYC again. How are you?
Glad to be with you.
So I turned on Bloomberg Radio last Friday night when your talk show was on, and I could hardly believe what I was hearing. Ed Koch saying, if I heard you correctly, tell me if I did, to stay in Iraq, but to get out of Afghanistan.
You got it half right.
Go ahead.
I did not say to stay in Iraq. I think we should get out of Iraq and get out of Afghanistan. And getting out of Afghanistan should be the priority. It's not a state that can be saved. The Russians were thrown out by the irregulars there. We now have 32,000 Americans in Afghanistan, and there are 30,000 NATO troops. Nobody wants to fight except for the non-American troops saying, let's the American troops fight. And what I mean by that is the Germans just sent another 1,000 soldiers to Afghanistan under their commitment, but they said they wouldn't go into the fighting area, which means that American soldiers have to do that. Afghanistan is poppy land. Their major product is heroin. We're the ones who receive it ultimately. And the New York Times had an editorial recently in which they said that Karzai, the president, his brother is probably the head of the drug rings in Afghanistan. So why are we fighting there? Now, I don't say that they're not terrorists. Let's bomb them and bomb them from safe havens that we occupy, either by missiles and do it from the United States or from allied properties in the Persian Gulf.
But you would have to believe then that we could get bin Laden and whatever significant al-Qaeda activity is reforming there with air power alone, which
the first thing is that if you read today's New York Times, the Afghanistan government and the United States are talking about reaching some kind of a treaty arrangement with the Taliban that used to be the government. And then when we bomb places in Afghanistan, as we bomb places in Pakistan where al-Qaeda is situated, we are denounced by both the Afghanistan government and the Pakistan government. We can't win. And what they would like to do is to leave us defenseless as it relates to casualties, but we should protect their borders, Afghanistan, and in effect protecting their drug trade. The New York Times said recently that Karzai's brother is delivering up to $100 million a year, the drug trade, to the Taliban Iran and their co-conspirators, I guess, Al-Qaeda.
Now, in general, the Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where the 9/11 plot was born, are considered to be the central front in the war on terrorism. Do you think that the Taliban would really make deals with the United States that would be enforceable, or are they just ideologically and religiously opposed to our existence?
The Islamic terrorists believe that the infidel, and we are the infidel, Christians and Jews, that we should be either converted by force or by agreement, or we should be dead, and they want to kill us. And I am saying, both in Iraq and Iraq, we're going to be thrown out at the latest by 2011 under the agreement that the United States is now seeking to enter into with Iraq. But if we don't get the agreement, we're going to be required under the UN resolutions to leave at the end of this year, as impossible as that may be. We are now in Iraq under a UN resolution that says we can stay there until December 31 of 2008, right. And after that, it is only by agreement with the Iraqi, right. And they've already conveyed they don't want us. Are we wasting precious American blood for what?
Before you go, if I might digress for a minute, Mayor Koch, you became popular as mayor, largely for helping lead New York out of the big fiscal crisis of the 1970s.
Right.
What advice would you give to Mayor Bloomberg or anyone else for leading New York out of today's situation?
Well, the first thing is Mayor Bloomberg doesn't need any advice because he's had a terrific 8 years, and he is the superb economist that we all know, with the huge success of having achieved a $20 billion fortune for himself. So I don't think he needs my advice. But if you're asking in a general way, what should we be doing? Well, I find it incredible that the United States government, the Treasury Department, and Bernanke at the Federal Reserve have failed to require the banks to make loans. Most people who talk about our current problem nationally say it's a matter of liquidity, meaning that the guy who wants to buy a car, the guy who wants to buy a house, other things, can't get money from the bank. And yet we're going to be giving money to the banks without the requirement that they do anything with it. And I think it's an outrage. What we should say to every bank that wants to participate in the $700 billion bailout is you must loan to credit-worthy applicants at the same rate that you did last year. And I've urged that on Bernanke and on the Secretary of the Treasury. Bernanke said it would be too difficult, which is ridiculous, and Paulson hasn't replied.
All right. Former Mayor Ed Koch, thank you very much for coming on with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, back to Afghanistan and Pakistan in a minute. Is it really a lost cause, an impossible task to fight in Afghanistan with the goals that both John McCain and Barack Obama have laid out? We'll talk to more guests about this and see if Ed Koch is out on his own or not here on WNYC. Stay tuned. Issues in 30 days, issue 29, Pakistan and Afghanistan. By the way, our final 30 issues wiki is now active at WNYC.org. has been all week, and we hope you will take part. It is for tomorrow's final 30 Issues program called Who'd Be the Best President for New York and New Jersey. If you haven't used a wiki before, it's not just a comments page. It's a way for you to collaborate with each other to help produce our series, suggest guests and questions and audio clips. Even the words that come out of my mouth sometimes come from the 30 Issues Wiki. Check out and contribute to the 30 Issues Wiki for Who'd Be the Best President for New York and New Jersey at wnyc.org/30issues. Now, can the next president follow in the footsteps of Alexander the Great, the British, and the Soviets and just walk away from Afghanistan, as Ed Koch suggests, except for air power? We continue now with Issue 29, and joining me to look at what the new administration will face, what's at stake, and what the candidates have to say about it are Steve Call, president and CEO of the New America Foundation and staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, several books on the topic, Barnett Rubin, Afghanistan expert and director of studies at the Center on International Cooperation at NYU, and Tariq Ali, novelist, historian, Pakistani-born Brit, and one of the New Left Review's editors. His new book is The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight of American Power. Welcome back to WNYC, all of you. And Afghanistan used to be, Steve Call, the good response to 9/11, as opposed to the Iraq War, the good war. There was broad international support. It's actually a NATO action. And the Taliban were routed. Remember the purple fingers after the elections there. What has happened?
Well, two things. The Taliban weren't routed. They were chased out of the cities, and they, at the time, said they would regroup in the countryside and in Pakistan, and they've done just what they said they would do. And then, secondly, the war was grotesquely under-resourced as the Bush administration turned almost immediately to invade Iraq, and then did so in a way that created a very long and very draining and demanding failing war for the ensuing 3 or 4 years, which took not just money and resources, but also talent and attention away from Afghanistan, which was the void that the Taliban exploited as they built themselves back, just as they said they would do.
Barnett Rubin, what would you add?
Well, I think that when people say that Afghanistan was the good war, what they mean was that it was the war for which there was justification, in the sense that the United States actually was attacked from Afghanistan and it was not attacked from Iraq. But that doesn't mean it was a well-conducted or successful war. That was an illusion that those of us who were on the ground saw from the very beginning. Unfortunately, things just happened a little slowly there, so it took a while for it to become so as evident as it is now.
Tariq Ali, is this a cross-border situation? I mean, we went in after al-Qaeda. Now we keep talking about the Taliban. How related are the Taliban and Afghanistan and al-Qaeda at this point? We know they were protecting al-Qaeda back in 2001. What's the relationship at this point? Tariq Ali?
Was to rout al-Qaeda, capture Osama bin Laden dead or alive, and destroy this organization. Al-Qaeda naturally didn't wait for this to happen. Being a mobile terrorist organization, they left Afghanistan and found refuge elsewhere, probably in the badlands bordering the two countries, according to all reports. And as a result of that, that particular aim of the war could never be fulfilled. Now, we don't know whether Osama's dead or alive. Many people in Pakistan think he's dead, but who knows? In any case, what has happened is that Afghanistan is now occupied, and the situation is going from bad to worse, and the Taliban have reformed. The British intelligence agencies refer to them as the neo-Taliban because they say it's a slightly different organization, and the West is trying to negotiate with them to join the government in Kabul. That is essentially what's going on.
So, Steve Call, both candidates, I think, are talking about a troop surge. We heard Mayor Koch say this is just, you know, a drain, a sinkhole for Americans, as it was a sinkhole for the Soviets before us, and we could go back further to the Brits and Alexander the Great. I want to play a clip of a McCain campaign. Let's see. This is actually a statement by Obama that the McCain campaign also used in one of their ads.
You've got to get the job done there. And that requires us to have enough troops that we're not just air raiding villages and killing civilians, which is causing enormous problems there.
Not just air raiding villages and killing civilians. Steve Call, you heard Mayor Koch argue that we could get bin Laden and keep al-Qaeda down and, you know, at the level of preventing another 9/11 plot from being hatched just by bombing them. Is that a very on-the-fringe opinion?
Well, I don't know how to measure its fringiness, but I don't think it's right. I don't think that it's possible, as recent as the evidence of the last 3 or 4 or 5 years has shown, to challenge either al-Qaeda or the Taliban by that strategy.
Anybody disagree with that? Barnett?
Well, go ahead, Tariq.
No, I agree with that. I think the strategy has failed. The civilian deaths have increased tenfold over the last 2 years, and this is creating mayhem in the region. There's a spillage of the war inside Pakistan. The border is being crossed by everyone regularly, and it is beginning to destabilize Pakistan quite seriously. So the question is, we need an exit strategy, and a new surge isn't going to help. I don't think troops on the ground are going to create a better situation, which is why the British ambassador to Afghanistan, Sherrod Cooper Coles, and a senior British military officer there have said, we don't want more troops. That is not going to solve anything.
So we have Tariq Ali and Ed Koch on the same side of the argument, something that doesn't happen every day.
Yeah, but I'm not in favor of more bombing either.
Yes.
I don't think they're on the same side of the argument at all, unfortunately.
Well, in terms of the futility of another ground troop surge, Barnett Rubin.
Look, first, we should understand what's actually going on there and what the various actors are trying to do. And we should disregard campaign rhetoric, which means three short talking points. It's the only reason that the international community is there in such force is because of the attacks of 9/11. But actually, the international community should have paid a lot more attention to that region before in order to prevent the conditions that led to that. And it should continue to be involved in the right way in order to prevent such things and other harmful things, both for the people there and for the international community, from happening in the future. Now, there's not just a war going on. There is also a massive, poorly organized, under-resourced, and uncoordinated attempt to assist Afghanistan and give some support to Pakistan. And if those were organized as part of a well-conceived political strategy in partnership with the people there, they could be successful. Bombing would not be an important part of such a strategy. The most hopeful thing that I see recently is the emergence of these attempts at dialogue and ultimately negotiation with as much of the insurgency in both Pakistan and Afghanistan as possible. I'd like to clear up one misconception that I think is common in the United States, and that is the misconception that the Taliban and al-Qaeda were co-conspirators in attacking the United States. The Taliban leadership did not know about al-Qaeda's plan to attack the United States. There are no Afghans in the leadership of al-Qaeda, and there are no Arabs in the leadership of the Taliban. The two organizations had a lot of differences. They were thrown together for various reasons, partly involving the strategy of the Pakistan Intelligence Agency, and other things I won't go into now. But within the Taliban leadership now, while there are some who have become more pro-al-Qaeda, much of the information that we get indicates that the leaders of the Taliban are trying to redefine themselves as an Afghan organization, not as part of a global jihadi movement.
Do you think, then, that although the idea of negotiating with al-Qaeda may be futile, that there is the possibility of negotiating with the Taliban, either leaders on the ground around the country, which is, I think, the idea that's being floated, or with some kind of central Taliban leadership to produce anything that they would be willing to agree to that benefits the United States?
Well, I'm not predicting that will happen, but unlike Amir Koch, I have actually talked to the leaders of the Taliban since 1997. I have spoken to some of those people recently as well, not the ones who are currently fighting. And there is a plausible framework for negotiation, not an agreement, but a framework. And basically, their bottom line is they don't want foreign troops in Afghanistan. Especially, they don't want foreign troops that are engaging in war and killing civilians. I think not only Taliban feel that way in Afghanistan. Our bottom line is we want absolute, strong guarantees that the territory of Afghanistan or Pakistan will not be used to attack us. Mm-hmm. Then we have many other political differences on many issues, but there's no need to fight a war over those things. They can be pursued in other ways. And I think that there's still a lot of problems, a huge number of problems about how they could be integrated into the government in a country that barely has a state. In Pakistan, it's quite difficult to figure out how to integrate the tribal agencies with the rest of Pakistan, especially when there's pressure from outside to take a military approach because of the presence of al-Qaeda there. But there is a possible framework, and it's very clear that there are significant people in the Taliban that are interested in pursuing it.
Barnett Rubin, Afghanistan expert at NYU. Tariq Ali, author of The Duel, Pakistan on the Flight Path of American Power. And Steve Call from the New America Foundation and The New Yorker, and author of Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, also the author of The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. And Steve Call, both candidates seem to be calling for a troop surge in Afghanistan. And the Washington Post reported yesterday that the Pentagon may double the increase that they want to send. Are more troops available, and how do you react to what our other guests have been saying about the perceived futility of what ground troops could accomplish?
I'm not sure if more troops are, as many as 20,000 are available anytime soon. It depends on decisions that if they've been made, haven't been announced about drawing down from Iraq, but even if the next administration moves aggressively to withdraw troops from Iraq, the pace at which they could be sent to Afghanistan is limited by logistics and numbers, and getting to 20,000 seems to me pretty tough anytime soon. As to what role they would play and whether they're the solution, I mean, I agree entirely with the idea that the way forward in both Pakistan and Afghanistan is primarily political, not military. I hope that the United States military has come to recognize this and talks about troop numbers as a subordinate element in a reconceived strategy that emphasizes politics, development, and aid in the totality of that strategy on both sides of the border. But since that strategy hasn't been cooked or approved or never mind announced to the public, I really don't know what it is that what strategy these troops would be serving. If the idea is that they're to serve the current strategy, then I think it would be a mistake.
Yeah, which goes against what both Obama and McCain are saying about what is needed there, which is a troop surge. But on the political approach, Steve Call, I wonder how you react to this clip of Obama from the first debate on part of the politics that he wants to press there.
We have to press the Afghan government to make certain that they are actually working for their people. And I've said this to President Karzai.
Is that part of America's job? Is that our responsibility? And could America be good at that, Steve Call?
Well, we've already tried it and proved that we're not very good at it, I think, in Afghanistan. But, the problem in Afghanistan is so complicated and difficult to describe, but it starts with the whole concept of nation building that we've tried to bring there since 2001, which has presumed an approach to aid and aid delivery that is completely disconnected from successful Afghan politics and has been about rewarding our own contractors and our own our own cycle of aid money flowing back to Washington, D.C., where it originated, rather than actually building a viable approach to regional and local and national politics in Afghanistan. On the Pakistan side of the border, we've made an analogous mistake, which is to invest very heavily in the military and to invest almost nothing in civil society and the creation of sustainable, peaceful, plural politics there. And any refitted strategy would have to start with those principles and then work pragmatically forward to a better flow of our aid and our political support.
30 Issues in 30 Days, our presidential election series, issue 29, Pakistan and Afghanistan. And to follow up on what Steve Cole just said, here is Obama again in the first debate, the foreign policy debate.
We've got to deal with Pakistan because Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have safe havens in Pakistan, across the border in the northwest regions. And although, you know, under George Bush, with the support of Senator McCain, we've been giving them $10 billion over the last 7 years, they have not done what needs to be done to get rid of those safe havens.
Tariq Ali, do you think that's accurate, that the U.S. has been giving Pakistan $10 billion over the last 7 years? They have not done what needs to be done to get rid of those safe havens? And if so, what have they done with that money?
Well, this is a very good question, and it's a question which many people in Pakistan are asking. I think one of the things they've done is to refurbish the military and buy equipment mainly from the United States to bring the military up to strength again. That's one reason they were delighted to receive that. But what needs to be done, I agree very much with what Steve said earlier, is that Pakistani civil society is in a state of complete crisis and collapse. There is no education system. There is no health system. There is no water service. Electricity in most cities today you can only get for a few hours each day. Many cities go without electricity for 14 days. And this social crisis is creating mayhem in different parts of the country. And neither the civilian nor the military elites in Pakistan have had any solutions to these problems. So some of that money should have been used to create a stable social infrastructure in Pakistan, which would have meant reducing the hold and the influence of some of the extremist religious organizations. And this has not been done.
America's main concern is how committed the Pakistani government is to fighting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the mountains. Do they see the Taliban as in Pakistan, in the government, do they see the Taliban more as part of a geopolitical balancing with India?
Well, of course they do. I mean, they've always, don't forget that one reason the Taliban in Afghanistan didn't fight back immediately is that the Pakistani military told them not to do so. The Taliban, by and large, was created from within Pakistan and then dispatched into Afghanistan to fight the civil war and to take over the country. So the Pakistani military saw this as a major victory, giving them strategic depth against India. It was always a foolish notion, and now looks even more foolish than before, which is why people like me are arguing that what we need in that whole area is a regional solution involving India, involving Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran to create a stable situation there. You cannot exclude other regional players, and the United States should be aware of that given what's going on in Iraq. I mean, they have to learn some of the lessons, the mistakes being made in Iraq. The Pakistani military, I think, gets as much money as it can. And it doesn't, you know, I mean, to be fair to them, you cannot expect the Pakistani military to go and kill people in its own border zones, because it's created a great deal of unrest within the military. And if this situation carries on indefinitely, the much vaunted unity of the Pakistani military will collapse, and that will create a disastrous situation.
Do either of you disagree with any of that, including the regional political approach?
I just wanted to mention, this is Barney Rubin, that together with my colleague Ahmed Rashid, a Pakistani journalist who I imagine Tariq knows, I've just published an article in the journal Foreign Affairs, which is on their website, about Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the region, which takes precisely the position that Tariq Ali just outlined and provides some more details of what that would mean. You know, Afghanistan is such a weak state that it can only be stable when its neighbors and the great powers don't see any threats coming from it. Otherwise, it's very easy to destabilize it. And that really is the key to creating the conditions for dealing with all these other problems.
So here's a little of what John McCain had to say about Pakistan from that same first foreign policy debate.
And we're going to have to help the Pakistanis go into these areas and obtain the allegiance of the people. And it's going to be tough. They've intermarried with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And it's going to be tough. But we have to get the cooperation of the people in those areas. And the Pakistanis are going to have to understand that bombing of the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad was a signal from the terrorists that they don't want that government to cooperate with us in combating the Taliban and jihadist elements.
Steve Call, it sounds to me, after, 36 minutes into this hour now, listening to these clips, listening to you and our other guests, that there may be some kind of major divide between expert opinion and political opinion, that Obama and McCain are saying, at least on the surface, essentially the same thing about a troop surge in Afghanistan and pressing the Pakistani government to fight in the mountains, and that there's a lot of expert opinion out there that says the situation is much more complicated than that, fleshed out the way you three have been fleshing it out. Would you say that's the case?
Well, I think that what you're observing is one of those typical things that happens during a campaign, which is that the candidates believe they have to emphasize certain simple equations in order to compete in the election, but beneath the surface, there is more complex discourse going on and more complex strategy being developed. I know that's true. On the Democratic side, I'm not so sure about the Republican side, because I think McCain's strategy is connected essentially to the Bush strategy that's being carried out now, which has emphasized even more unilateral military action over a refitted political or regional strategy. So in the case of whoever the next president is, they're going to receive in the first, actually during the transition, a whole series of proposals for new strategic approaches. And I think articles like the one that Barney and Ahmed have just published are going to be influential in the formulation, are already influential in the formulation of those approaches. And there's going to be advice coming from experts on the civilian side, outside the government, people like Barney. There's going to be advice of a related but distinct character coming from CENTCOM, the principal military command that has a new general who's rewriting strategy right now and will present it to the next president. And there'll be new advice coming from the Joint Chiefs and from whatever government is assembled by the next president. So there will be a new strategy, and I think it will be in the general vicinity of what Barney's recommending. But whether it will really go as far and be as creative as it needs to be, given the difficulty and complexity of the problem, I'm not so confident.
To your ear, Steve, are Obama and McCain saying anything different in the campaign?
I think they're saying very similar things, but beneath that sort of rhetorical competition lies, in McCain's case, a predilection to rely upon military mechanisms. In Obama's case, I think an openness to a more political and diplomatic and economic and integrated strategy. At least I hope that the latter will prove to be the case.
Barney Rubin, do you agree? Is there any evidence to that other than their general temperaments?
Well, yes. I mean, I've been in close contact with the advisors on the Obama campaign, which I'm supporting, and to a lesser extent with people on the McCain campaign. First of all, the big difference is Obama emphasizes that Afghanistan is extremely important, that Iraq was a mistake, and that we should disengage ourselves from it. That means he is much more willing to free resources, not only troops, but other kinds of resources from Iraq to be used in Afghanistan. In addition, he's called for dialogue with Iran, which is very necessary for the regional approach that we have all been talking about, and he's a co-sponsor of the Biden-Lugar-Obama bill for aiding the civilian side of institutions in Pakistan as well. So clearly he understands the importance of that.
And Tariq Ali, do you think that it will be any easier for Obama to get what the United States wants from Pakistan because he's Obama, or are they going to just kind of sniff and say, oh, yeah, you think you're such an international hotshot, and do what they do?
Well, no. I think it's a question of what Obama really wants to do. I think his rhetoric has been very hawk-like in the campaign, and I did wonder whether, having taken a position against the Iraq war, he felt he had to show that he was tough on some war. But one hopes that it is election rhetoric and that sense will prevail. After all, one of his former advisors, Brzezinski, knows the region well and knows the mess that was created in that region when the Soviets were there. And why and how this mess has partially led to the situation we confront today, and that therefore that a proper exit strategy involving all the regional powers is necessary. And I stress all the regional powers, because I am not in favor of handing over the country to Pakistani military intelligence and the Taliban again. I don't think this would be good for Afghanistan, and it could even lead to the breakup of this very fragile state. So I'm definitely in favor of involving Iran and India and possibly the Russians as well.
The clip that we played of McCain said the Pakistanis are going to have to understand that that bombing in the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad was a signal from the terrorists that they don't want that government to cooperate with us in combating the Taliban and jihadist elements. Was the Taliban behind that bombing of the Marriott, Tariq? Is that known?
Well, we don't know exactly. Pakistan, you know, when these bombings take place, the people who carried them out sometimes claim them, sometimes don't, and it's a very murky situation there, but I think there's no doubt it was carried out by people hostile to the military actions which have been taking place in Swat and the tribal areas. And it was a warning. And the fact is that the New America Foundation carried out a very interesting opinion poll in the country several months ago, which pointed that about 60 to 70% of the population are deeply hostile to the U.S. presence in that region. And I think this
But if it was the Taliban that committed the bombing, does that make Pakistan more committed to fighting them?
Not necessarily, precisely because of what I'm pointing out, that the United States presence in Afghanistan is not popular inside Pakistan at all. And so the military and the political elite in the country have to walk a tightrope. And the Marriott bombing was a warning to them that this is what can happen if you carry on the way you're carrying on, which is why I've been arguing now for a long time that we need a proper exit strategy and we need a program, a social program to stabilize that region. It cannot be done through war, more military spending, or occupations.
Tariq Ali, author of The Duel, Barnett Rubin, Afghanistan expert at NYU, Steve Cole from the New America Foundation and The New Yorker, his books Ghost Wars and the Bin Ladens. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 29, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And coming up in a minute, we'll hear from NPR, former NPR correspondent Sarah Chase, who's been living in a village in Afghanistan since the war began. We'll get her take on how villagers react to all of these things now that we've heard from three international politics experts. And we will also get a take from Pakistani-American blogger Sabahat Ashraf, who used to be an intern with this show. Stay with us. Issues in 30 Days, Issue 29, Pakistan and Afghanistan. And on election night, we will start our coverage at 7 o'clock with election night coverage from WNYC and National Public Radio. I'll be here with Amy Eddings and our political director, Andrea Bernstein, plus the entire NPR election unit. And we will have a running live chat online Tuesday night, your election night companion at WNYC.org. It all starts at 7 o'clock because that's when the polls close in a few important little places like Virginia and most of Florida and Indiana, 7 o'clock Tuesday night for election night coverage. And finally today, we're going to talk to two people who have experience on the ground in Pakistan and Afghanistan to understand how big policy decisions affect everyday life in these countries. Joining us now are Sabahat Ashraf, a blogger covering events in Pakistan who makes his living as a technical writer in the Silicon Valley. And as I mentioned earlier, used to be an intern on this show. And Sarah Shays, a former NPR reporter who founded the Argan Cooperative in Kandahar, Afghanistan, after deciding to leave journalism and stay there in 2002. So welcome back, both of you, to WNYC. Hi there.
Hi. Great to be with you.
Morning, Brian. And nice to be back.
Sarah Chase, tell us just first briefly by way of background why you decided to stay in Afghanistan and what the Argan Cooperative is.
It seemed like the most important thing that I could do at the time, and still does. And it's not about, I mean, Afghanistan is famous for causing people to fall in love with it. So a lot of people see me as being one of these people who's been captivated by the country, which is certainly true, but is secondary. What was really important to me was to try to contribute to an effort to counter prevailing ideology in some parts of the Western world, as well as some parts of the Muslim world, that became very loud after 9/11, which was this clash of civilizations idea. And I don't believe in it. I believe that we live in an interconnected world, and it was very important to support and encourage that interconnectedness. And it seemed to me that Kandahar was the place to do it, if any. And I really still feel that way. I feel like that's the most important struggle of our generation.
And the Argonne Co-op, which you founded in 2005, makes natural skincare products from local fruits and botanicals, but that is in the part of the long-term goal of your group is to help wean southern Afghanistan off its dependent on the opium poppy and have sustainable economic development. Barack Obama has also talked about the growing poppy trade there is a reason that the United States needs to be involved. How much does the opium trade affect the economic opportunities of people living in Kandahar?
Oh, it's determinant. I mean, it is. This is a $4 billion industry, and we experience it ourselves when we want, for example, to hire someone to collect a flower, for example, that we distill to get essential oil to scent our soaps. We can't find any labor in May because everybody is working in the poppy fields. I mean, it's a totally integrated part of the local economy.
And is it integrated also with the Taliban to any extent, and can the United States fight one without fighting the other?
To some degree, but I actually think the more dangerous integration is with the Afghan government. I mean, every single ranking government official in southern Afghanistan is involved in the poppy trade one way or another.
And there's something about Karzai's brother, right?
Yeah, he is sometimes dubbed the biggest opium dealer in the Afghan South. I don't think that's accurate. What I do think he does is he does profit financially from the trade, but more by providing safe conduct for it's a little bit cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that you then get into a kind of mafiaization of the whole government structure, because if he's appointing police officials or district chiefs according to whether or not they will allow convoys of his friends or people who have paid him off to pass through police checkposts, well, then the entire government system has become corrupted. And what the Afghan people don't understand is that we still deal with people like President Karzai's younger brother or other government officials who are deeply involved in the trade on a cordial basis, and yet we're eradicating farmers' fields. So they say, now, wait a second, if there's a counter-narcotics policy here, why is it being so disproportionately applied?
Help us hurt them instead of the other way around. Well, Sabahat, you've been to Pakistan a number of times this year, and you wrote on your blog, I am reminded of something my father said 20-plus years ago. Over the decades, Pakistan has made wonderful progress in everything except politics. Explain that.
Okay. I guess the explanation for that is that we seem to be going around in circles. Over the last 60 years, we've been through at least three, if not more, cycles of having a democracy and a civil society, and then having that being overtaken by a military dictatorship, and then the military dictatorship running its course, having its own natural cycle, and then handing off to another civilian dispensation and then going through that cycle again, so that today again we're back where we were either in 1988 or 1971 or maybe at the very beginning of 47.
With implications obviously for the Pakistani people, but also for the United States?
Well, if you want to look at it with implications for the United States, you'll also notice that each of these cycles has also had a cycle of relationship with the United States, where Pakistan has been critical to something the United States was doing, in the late 60s, early 70s, it was, you know, reaching out to China in the Cold War. In the 80s, it was 80s and early 90s, it was Afghanistan. And today, again, it is Afghanistan again, but in a different way. And the important thing to remember there is that the Pakistani people, from their point of view, what the U.S. has done in each of these cases is, for want of a better word, use Pakistan for their own ends and then drop it like a hot potato the moment their ends were met.
And the new,
and which leads to, again, leads to a situation where things fester and then it starts all over again.
So the new president of Pakistan, Asif Ali Zardari, spoke in New York during his visit to the United Nations General Assembly this fall about how the fight against terrorism was Pakistan's war, not America's. That was his way of saying, U.S., stop coming across the border and attacking without our permission?
I think the phrase he used was Benazir Bhutto's war, not Charlie Wilson's war. I'd say it's actually maybe a little deeper than that. This might be going off on a slight tangent, but I guess Asif Zardari is at the top of an establishment right now that has to basically, what you might say, mediate between the Pakistani street and the U.S. establishment's needs. What I keep telling people in terms of the street is that the one thing every Pakistani in Pakistan has taken away from this election cycle in the U.S., if there is one thing they remember, it is Obama saying that we'll bomb Pakistan.
Yeah.
And that,
go ahead.
That has implications for convincing Pakistani, especially after the Marriott bombing in Islamabad. Every Pakistani in their heart of heart knows this is something that is, you know, from our society. We have to handle it. It's coming from here. But being able to take that position is complicated by the United States dropping bombs on civilians and making it a situation where Pakistanis, and in fact, Pakistanis use the phrase America's war on terror without any sarcasm, and they do it much more often and much more comfortably than we do in the U.S. And that's the problem. America has made it America's war on terror. So if we want it to be Pakistan's struggle against fanaticism, then we have to let it play out as Pakistan's struggle against fanaticism, right?
Yeah. Sarah Shays, you've written that people are murdered in Kandahar on a weekly basis for their involvement in the current nation-building effort, and that the women are under particular pressure. How do you think the violence towards civilians, women in particular, would be affected if the United States left Afghanistan? Our previous guests seem to imply that that's going to be inevitable despite everybody's current talk about a troop surge.
Oh, if the U.S. and NATO at large were to leave Afghanistan in the anything like the near future, I mean, it would dissolve into an incredible bloodbath. It really would be a repetition. It's not just Pakistan that's been dropped like a hot potato. Afghanistan has been dropped like a hot potato in particular once the Soviets withdrew in 1989. And if we were to go through that cycle again, I think it's clear that the results would be the same.
So
there's a level of disaffection with the Afghan government that we in effect ushered into power, that is very, very high, because that government has just been treating its civilians or its citizens like subjects to be pillaged, basically, and it really would not last out the day if it didn't have the backing of the U.S. and ISAF forces.
So do you think that we're going to run out of time soon, but do you think that the people who you live and work with in the Kandahar region are following the U.S. election, and are they rooting for the kind of troop surge that both of the candidates are proposing?
Absolutely. They're closely following the election. They are very partisan. They are in favor of a troop surge, but they're mostly in favor of a different approach, which would involve a kind of democratic revival in Afghanistan. I'm often asked whether it's right for us to impose democracy, you know, on peoples who just don't want it or aren't ready for it, whereas Afghans experience that we've obstructed a post Taliban democratic reawakening in Afghanistan by backing very abusive government officials and not calling them to account.
You said very partisan toward whom?
Obama.
And in Pakistan, Sabahat?
I would say, to a large extent, yes, Obama, because, and to a large extent, for some of the same reasons that a lot of people in the U.S. are supporting him, in the sense of he's a new face, he has a new approach. He'll most probably change some policies, because at the top of it, him and McCain are not very different in what they're saying they will do right now. But I think hope sort of wins out over actual facts right now.
Sabahat Ashraf, a blogger covering events in Pakistan who makes his living as a technical writer in the Silicon Valley. Sarah Chase, former NPR reporter who founded the Argonne Cooperative in Kandahar after deciding to stay in Afghanistan in 2002. Thank you both very much.
Thanks for having us.
And that is 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 29, Afghanistan and Pakistan. Tomorrow, Issue 30, we wrap it all up with who'd be the better president for New York and New Jersey. Also tomorrow, Donna Brazile, Al Gore's campaign manager, very outspoken in this race. And don't forget that WNYC political director Andrea Bernstein and I discuss the presidential campaign over lunch and put it online in a podcast every week. It's Digesting Politics, a web-only feature that you won't hear on the radio. We'll be recording a new one this afternoon. Sign up for the Digesting Politics podcast for free at WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer with you. Have a great day.